From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Murders on the Crumbles. Long before Patrick Mahan murdered his mistress Emily Kay in a rented bungalow on the Crumbles, this lonely stretch of beach near Eastbourne in Sussex was haunted. Some friends of mine who stayed in the locality for a short time told me they had authentic information regarding the haunting. Their information, a married couple had on several occasions seen in broad daylight the apparition of a man in the uniform of a Coast Guard climbing over the windowsill of the bungalow sitting room and crossed the floor to into the room leading out of the sitting room. He vanished invariably and inexplicably in the inner room of the empty bungalow. Though I made many inquiries, there was no information to be had regarding a possible reason for this haunting. After this, in the early 1920s, the Crumbles became notorious for two headline murders: the savage battering to death of Irene Monroe, a London typist, and the gruesome dispatch of his mistress, Emily Kay, by Patrick Mahan. In August of 1920, pretty young Irene Monroe went to Eastbourne for a fortnight's holiday alone. She took a room at 393 Seaside, the district of Eastbourne, beyond which lies the Crumbles. On August 19, she was seen with two men in gray suits in the vicinity of the Crumbles. The next afternoon, her cruelly battered body, robbed of the little money she possessed, was found by a schoolboy buried under the shingle. William Gray and Jack Field, two unemployed men, known to the police as bad characters, were tried and convicted of her murder and were hanged together at Wandsworth Prison in February 1921. 3 years later, on this fateful beach, Patrick Mahan murdered his mistress. Emily Kay was a London woman with money who became fascinated with Mahan, a vain and unscrupulous married man. He was reluctant to continue the affair, and she suggested a love experiment, that they should live together on trial, and drew his attention to an advertisement for a bungalow to let on the Crumbles. Mahan rented it for 2 months under the name of Waller. There, in April of 1924, he murdered her, having bought some of the instruments he used beforehand, and sealed her in a cabin trunk while entertaining a few nights later another woman he had invited to the bungalow. He then remained about the place for days, destroying Emily Kay's body. He hacked the flesh into pieces with a carving knife, sawed up the bones, boiled the remains, and burned the head in a stove, breaking the skull bones to bits and throwing them away on the shingle. He also disposed of some pieces of the body by dropping them from the train on the way to Reading, and it was the discovery of his Gladstone bag, which he had deposited at Waterloo Station, which brought him to justice. It contained bloodstained clothing in which the pieces had been wrapped, and the knife. Mahan was also hanged at Wandsworth Prison. I stayed one night in the Crumbles' bungalow while he was awaiting execution. Except for the removal of boards by the police, bits and pieces of the corpse were found at the bungalow. The sitting room was just as it had been when Mahan left the place. It was a weird experience, though as hour after hour passed, I neither heard nor saw anything supernatural. Nothing occurred till dawn broke. Then the gray rays of early morning seemed to focus on the aperture in the floor, where the police had been searching for clues or remains. I then saw emanating from the hole a gruesome light, which may have been due to vegetable decay. Whatever the cause of it, it had a very chilling effect on me. I sensed the presence of evil near me, but saw nothing beyond the eerie light. I was glad when the hour for my departure arrived. I also spent the night on the Crumbles near the spot where poor Irene Monroe was murdered. Again, at about 4 o'clock in the morning, I saw an eerie light rise up from the shingle, and again was conscious of an evil presence or presences near me for a time. They went with the advent of sunlight. Whatever new manifestations of the supernatural the two shocking murders may have brought to the place, the Crumbles is well known to have been haunted long before the pitiful death of Irene Monroe. Skeletons have from time to time been found there. Phantom vehicles. A fatal accident to motorists alleged to have been caused by the appearance of a phantom lorry on the road near Hyde and Cheshire aroused renewed interest in phenomena representing inanimate objects. I can understand living things such as humans, quadrupeds and birds, and even fish and insects, in fact, all things that have life, appearing on this earth as ghosts, a woman writer remarked to me. But surely it is impossible for non-sentient, non-sensitive, and utterly lifeless objects, such as trains or motor cars, to appear, since they obviously don't possess anything in the nature of a spirit. Well, of course, she had a point, but all the same, it is a well-established fact that the superphysical does at times manifest itself in the form of ships, motor cars, and trains, and I think those who have really experienced ghostly happenings will agree that the constitution of such phenomena is at present, even to the most enlightened and scientifically minded, merely a matter of hypothesis and speculation. It should not be forgotten, however, that because these phenomena that we term ghostly appear to us to be superphysical, that is to say, without any satisfactory explanation on purely material and natural grounds, they will always remain so. With regards to phantom vehicles, be what they may, entities hailing from the superphysical or phenomena explicable on some at present unknown physical basis, they are not uncommon. For a long time, the road between Rugby and Coventry was periodically haunted by a phantom lorry that emerged from a hedge and, crossing the road, vanished quite inexplicably into the hedge opposite, while a phenomenon resembling a motor coach had been seen from time to time on the road between Lamberthurst and Frant on the Kent-Sussex border. The latter, unlike so many phantoms, does not confine its appearance to the night, but apparently seen quite as often during the day. Only recently it appeared in broad daylight to three motorists collectively. They saw it ahead of them, standing motionless by the wayside, and did not realize there was anything strange about it till it suddenly vanished. As there was no gap in the hedge, no side turning or other outlet to account for its abrupt disappearance, they could only conclude that it was superphysical. Another daylight haunting by a vehicle is said to occur periodically on the main road between Swindon and Hungerford. The spot where the phenomena would seem most often to appear is close to the summit of a slight hill. On either side, the road is meadowland protected by a barbed wire fence. Recently, a party of motorists ascending this hill in daylight saw what they took to be a private car cross the road in front of them and then suddenly disappear. They were all looking at it one moment and the next merely gazing into space. Utterly unable to explain the phenomena, for the barbed wire fence by the roadside was perfectly intact, they drove on, thrilled with the idea that they had at last, and in every truth, seen a ghost. Recently, considerable sensation was aroused in the neighborhood of Bath, owing to stories told by certain lorry drivers of strange happenings on the road between Banford and Salisbury. It seems that some time ago this road was the scene of a serious motor car accident, and ever since then it is alleged to have been haunted not only by the phantoms of the people who were killed in the accident, but by the phantom of their car as well. Drivers of lorries declare that when passing the spot where this tragedy occurred, they have heard harrowing screams and groans, and at the same time have seen a much damaged car that has invariably and quite unaccountably vanished on their approaching close to it. A driver on one occasion, hearing cries, looked on the ground and seeing in the moonlight the livid face of a dead man staring at him, was so startled that he fainted, while on another occasion a driver at the same spot felt something icy cold touch his hand, the hand that steered, and on glancing down, saw to his horror a bloody hand close beside his own. All these experiences were narrated at the time in the press and corroborated by people living in the haunted district. The story of a phantom locomotive was told me years ago by a railway porter at Kensham near Bristol. He declared that when on duty at Kensham station, he, together with one or two of the other porters, had repeatedly seen a phantom engine pass through the station in the direction of the tunnel between Kensham and Bristol. This phenomenon did not always occur at night. It was sometimes seen in broad daylight. The porter and his mates would be standing on the platform talking, perhaps waiting for the next train, when suddenly an engine would appear on the line, coming fairly swiftly towards them. It made no sound whatever, but passed through the station in absolute silence, while the driver turned slowly round and looked at the men on the platform with a very pale face and troubled expression. My informant said that once either the driver or fireman of an engine had fallen off in the tunnel under very mysterious circumstances and been killed, and that the phantom engine was thought to owe its origin to that tragedy. The haunting has apparently ceased, but maybe only temporarily, for it often happens that the same psychic phenomena occurs time after time in rapid succession, and then abruptly ceases, to reoccur in the same way years later. However, it is just as impossible to say when the same haunting will occur again as it is to say exactly how many times it will reappear, as all hauntings are more or less intermittent, and in my opinion, they may go on thus forever. A train haunting no less interesting occurred in the 70s of the last century at Newark, in the United States. Regularly about the same hour every day, a phantom engine used to be heard approaching the station and dash shrieking and whistling through it. People came from all parts to hear the phenomenon, as many as 600 or 700 experiencing it at a time. All attempts to explain away the phenomenon on natural grounds failed, and it was generally agreed in the end that it was superphysical, that is to say, due to some ghostly legacy or agency. It ceased as abruptly as it had begun, and up to the present has never reoccurred. From ghost trains to something new, the ghost airplane, I have on record that I believe to be the only case in Britain of a phantom plane. It was brought to my notice only recently by a woman who told me that when flying in Gloucestershire, both she and her pilot had seen the ghost plane. It came swiftly towards them from a distance, and when in line but slightly above them, suddenly vanished. The sky was absolutely clear at the time. There was not the vestige of a cloud, nothing that could in any way explain the phenomenon, which they could only account for on the basis of the superphysical. I see no logical reason why the air should not be haunted by phantom vehicles just as badly as the soil and the sea. There are, of course, many stories of phantom ships seen on the world's oceans, though some hauntings around the coast of Britain are not so widely known. Among the British cases of a phantom ship is that of the Rotterdam, a fine vessel full of passengers that sank off the northeast coast of Scotland with the loss of every person on board. Her phantom is still to be seen at times about the spot where she perished. Many years ago, a ship was wrecked through malice in the Solway. She contained a bridal party whose ghosts are visible on the deck when the phantom of the ship appears before a wreck. The phantoms of two pirate ships are also seen at times in the Solway. The pirates, on account of their many crimes, are fated to haunt the Solway till doomsday. There is a well-known instance of a phantom ship in St. Ives Bay, Cornwall. One day in the last century, light signals of distress were seen coming from a ship in the bay, and a boat at once pulled out towards her. The crew of the ship were plainly visible on deck. The rescue boat drew alongside her, and a man with a boat hook stood ready to board her. He launched his boat hook to clutch the vessel's side, but to his amazement it touched nothing, and the ship vanished, to reappear in another part of the bay. The crew of the boat knew then the vessel was a notorious phantom ship. A day or two later there was a storm, and a ship was wrecked in the bay. The appearance of the phantom ship always preceded a maritime disaster. There are other ghost ships reputed to peer off the Cornish coast, and even the shore has its phantoms. Senen Cove is haunted by a gray band of mist called the Hooper or Hooter. Its appearance is a warning to sailors not to put to sea. Once an old seaman, in a fit of bravado, declared he would beat the Hooper away when it manifested itself. The daunting mist appeared, and accompanied by some young men, he beat his way out to sea through it. But a storm arose, and he and his young companions were all drowned. Along the coast of South Wales, there is a strong belief in a haunted ship, and in hauntings by the spirit of the drowned. Ghost lights are seen before drowning calamity. The Dance of the Bat. Several theaters are haunted. Drury Lane Theatre is haunted by the ghost of a man clad in 18th century costume. It appears during the day as well as at night and has often been seen. The Haymarket Theater is said to be haunted by the ghost of a former owner. The Gaiety Theater had a haunted room. The Bath Theater is claimed to be haunted by the ghost of a woman in a gray dress, while the Old Theater Bristol is rumored to be haunted by the ghost of Mrs. Siddons. A provincial repertory theater, which, although it has now been pulled down, I must call the Lavinia Theater, had the strangest story of a theater haunting that has come to my knowledge. It was hearing that the theater was haunted which inspired Mr. Eric Cross, not his real name, member of a local group of psychic researchers, with the idea of holding a night vigil there. Cross was rather doubtful that he would be given permission for his experiment, but after some hesitation on the part of the owner, he finally obtained it. He consequently went alone to the theater at 11 o'clock one late October night, the night watchman letting him in. "You will find it very lonesome sitting all by yourself in the theater at night," the watchman said. "I don't mind that," Cross said. "Is there any truth in the rumors that the theater is haunted?" "Well," the watchman replied, "they do say it is, and I've heard things here that are hard to believe. Round about 2 o'clock is the time the noises sometimes come. Where do you want to sit?" "Oh, anywhere in the auditorium, about midway." "Very good," the watchman said. "Follow me." He led Cross to a seat in the middle of the auditorium. "You want a light, don't you?" he asked. "No," Cross said. "I want to sit in the dark. I have a torch." The watchman looked at him as if he thought him a very queer being. "Well, I shall be somewhere about if you want me," he said. Cross had no idea how lonely and deserted a theater could feel, till he heard the watchman's receding footsteps and found himself alone in the dark in the big empty auditorium. There was, he reported, an uncomfortable, eerie feeling. It was some consolation to feel his torch. As the minutes went by till midnight, he heard certain creakings and jarrings which he attributed to natural causes. As it drew near to 2 o'clock, he sensed presences all around him. The auditorium seemed to be full of invisible beings. Gradually, something began to form on the bare stage, the curtains of which had, at his request, been left open, and for the first time Cross experienced a pang of terror. What was he about to see? Very slowly, the something on the stage took shape. It was, he said, the fantastically dressed figure of a girl, her head crowned with the head of a bat. On her shoulders were bat-like wings. A weird light surrounded her as she fleetingly danced a strange, grotesque dance. The girl's face was so hidden by her headdress that Cross could not distinguish it. Her dance ended abruptly and she disappeared, swallowed up in the darkness of the back of the stage. Her place was rapidly filled by the spectral figures of two men engaged in a duel. The same weird light enveloped them. Cross then saw, leaning out of one of the boxes nearest to the stage, the startlingly white face of what looked like a clown, and leaning forward, gazing intently at the duelers from a seat adjoining the lowest boxes, was a dark-haired girl in whose eyes was an expression of the most deadly hatred. In one hand she held a pistol, and leveling it at one of the duelers, she fired. There was the hollow, reverberating sound of a report, and all the phantoms vanished. The darkness of the theater, suddenly returned, seemed like a physical blow to his smarting eyes, Cross recalled, so that he was some moments recovering from the double shock. He then flashed his torch around, and finding a light switch, turned it on. He had sat down again, still too unnerved by what he had seen to consider his next move, when the watchman reappeared. "Had enough of it, sir?" he inquired. "Yes, more than enough," Cross replied. Guardedly, he told the watchman a little of what he had seen. "The governor will be very interested," the watchman said. "Bar the shape of the woman, it's more than I or anyone else has ever seen." Cross then saw Mr. B., the owner of the theater, and narrated his experience to him. Mr. B., until now quite skeptical of Cross's vigil, was profoundly interested. 40 years ago, he said, "there was a mysterious happening here. A play called The Bat of the Astral Mountains was on, and the principals in it were John Vane, Richard Ellis, Dulcie Bourne, Vera Carter, and Robert Dean. Vane and Ellis were both very much in love with Dulcie Bourne, who was the Bat. She did a wonderful dance as the Bat. One of her understudies was Vera Carter, who was believed to be in love with John Vane. One night, when Vane and Ellis were engaged in a duel on the stage, Vane was shot and killed. Robert Dean, who played the part of a clown and was known to be on bad terms with Vane, was suspected. He was proved to have threatened Vane, but there was not enough evidence to warrant his arrest. Andre Lehan, Vane's understudy, took his part and did so well that the play, in spite of the tragic happening, proved a success. From what you tell me you saw, it looks like as if Dean was innocent. I have a photograph in one of my stage albums of Vera Carter. Will you look at it and see if it resembles the girl who fired the pistol? He found the photograph and showed it to Cross. Cross identified it at once as the girl who had fired. Her features were the same, well-formed, the dark eyes a little too close together. But why should she have killed Vane? Cross asked. That must remain a mystery, Mr. B said. Probably she had been very much in love with Vane. Vane had rejected her, and furious with his treatment of her, rather than he should marry Dulcie Bourne, she had killed him. Cross wrote down the account of his night's vigil, and Mr. B, independently, his own comments made at the time, just as I have stated, Mr. B was satisfied that it was impossible for Cross, a young man, to have had intimate knowledge of the plays and players at the Lavinia Theatre so many years before. White Ladies and the Headless. The grey-white wraiths of female phantoms have long been a popular feature of ghost tales, though in fact they far outnumber their fictional counterparts. They have been seen to appear with varying degrees of clarity, from shadowy indistinctness to a very full and detailed gleaming white figure. Blind Kinsop Castle in Northumberland is haunted by a white lady. A great treasure is supposed to have been buried there in the days of the Crusades. Bridgend House, Burnley, Crook Hall near Durham, and Waddle Hall, Yorkshire, all have their white lady ghosts. The one at Waddle Hall is called Peg O'Neill. White ladies do not haunt only castles and some stately homes. The old rectory at Market Lavington, Wiltshire, pulled down some years ago, was haunted by a white lady, the ghost of a woman murdered in the house, while the road leading from Market Lavington to Easterton was haunted by a phantom woman in white known as the Easterton Ghost. A curious story is told of the White Lady of Skipsey, Yorkshire. A woman sent one of her servants one day to some friends living some distance away. The servant was riding on his way when his horse started suddenly, nearly unseating him. He looked around to see what had scared the animal and saw walking by the head of his horse a woman in a white dress. Although his horse began to go fast, the woman kept pace with it. She continued walking by the horse till they reached Skipsey, where she vanished suddenly. The servant, much frightened, delivered his message and rode hard for home. At Barton Hall, near Bath, two sisters, May and Mary Dean, who were guests there, had retired to bed one night. May was actually in bed, while Mary was looking for something in the chest of drawers, when the door opened and a woman entered the room. Without looking to see who it was, May called out, "Is that you, Mary?" Whereupon Mary turned, saw the intruder, gave a loud shriek of terror, and fell on the bed in a semi-faint. May jumped out of bed and followed the intruder, who went into the dressing room, closing the door behind her. May at once opened the door, but the room was empty. The mysterious intruder had inexplicably vanished. Considerably mystified, May returned to Mary, who explained the reason for her terror. The strange woman, she said, had no features on her face, which was just a white gleaming oval. A cottage not far from Farley in Somerset, and the ground in its vicinity are reputed to be haunted by the ghost of a little woman in a long grey dress and an old-fashioned bonnet. The ghost is supposed to be that of a woman who once lived in the cottage and was greatly attached to it. All female phantoms, of course, do not appear as grey or white figures. Holt Castle in Warwickshire is said to be haunted by a black lady who glides through the building in the dead of night. A cellar in this castle was long supposed to be haunted by a very aggressive ghost of a raven. At Netherby Hall in Cumberland, there is a ghost known as the Rustling Lady, whose dress rustles as she moves at night along the corridors and through the rooms of the old house. The beach at St. Ives, Cornwall, is reputed to have been once haunted by the ghost of a woman with a lantern. According to a story and explanation of the haunting, a woman was formerly saved from a wreck, but her child was drowned. After her death, her ghost is believed to have been seen hunting at midnight for the body of her child. On the north coast of Cornwall, there is a haunted rock known as Madge Fig's Chair. Madge Fig took part in robbing the victims of the wreckers. Among them on one occasion was a woman wearing precious stones, and Madge Figg robbed the dead woman, whose ghost afterwards haunted the rock on which Madge Figg used to sit watching for wrecks. Mickle, the Scottish poet, wrote these verses about Cumnor Hall in Berkshire, the site of which is supposed to be haunted by the ghost of Lady Anne Robsart, who was murdered there in the reign of Queen Elizabeth. In that manner now no more is cheerful feast and sprightly ball, for ever since that dreary hour have spirits haunted Cumnor Hall. The village maids with fearful glance avoid the ancient moss-grown wall, nor ever lead the merry dance among the groves of Cumnor Hall. Full many a traveller oft has sighed and pensive wept the countess fall, as wandering around they spied the haunting towers of Cumnor Hall. Then there are the headless phantoms. For many years, a country mansion near the old village of Combe St. Winifred in Devon was haunted by the ghost of a headless woman clad in the dress of a bygone age. Every night, usually about 2 a.m., it glided along the passages and corridors, pausing here now and then to tap on doors. Sometimes it entered rooms, approached the people in bed, and roused them by placing an icy hand on their foreheads. One of the sleepers who was thus awakened had the temerity to rise and follow the ghost. It took him to a cellar, pointed to a certain spot in the stone flag floor, and vanished. In the morning, the spot in the stone that the ghost had indicated was dug up and some hidden valuables discovered there. The haunting by the same ghost continued until someone again followed it, and it revealed more treasure, after which it never appeared again. Drumlanrig Castle in Dumfrieshire was at one time haunted by a headless phantom woman supposed to be the Duchess of Queensberry, while a headless woman in white still haunts Crossroads, where a murderer was buried, 2 miles from Wenlock on the Bridgnorth Road. A well-known story is told of a haunted field at Great Melton, Norfolk, close to the old Norwich Road. Many years ago, a bridal party, returning home along the old Norwich Road, met with an appalling accident. They and their carriage were thrown into a deep pit, with the result they were all killed. For years afterwards, at midnight, a carriage drawn by headless horses, with a headless coachman and footman, containing headless ladies in white, used to be seen rising from the pit and driving round the large field. This done, it sank into the pit and vanished. At Dalton, near Thirsk, there was some years ago a barn reputed to be haunted. A tramp who went to sleep in the barn one night was roused from his slumber by the luminous ghost of a woman holding her head in her hands. Terrified, he crashed out of the barn and fled. Within recent years, a man was driving a wagon along a lane at Ellesmere, Shropshire, when the phantom of a headless woman suddenly appeared near a spot where suicide was known to be buried. The horses of the wagon took fright and pitched the driver into Drumby Hole, a dismal spot with an eerie reputation. He died very soon afterwards. Other headless phantoms abound. The region around Skipsea, haunted by its white lady, is also visited by a headless man on a phantom horse, while years ago a headless ghost haunted the streets of Preston and the neighboring lanes. Holland House is reputed to be haunted by a ghost that is headless. According to well-known tradition, the phantom of the First Lord Holland issues at midnight from a secret hideaway in the guilt room and wanders around the house. There are spots of blood on one side of the place from which he issues that cannot be effaced. There was a story current a few years ago that at times at midnight in the village of Acton, Suffolk, a coach with a headless horses, coachmen and footmen, were seen to drive very fast from the park to a place called the Nursery Corner, where centuries before a battle was fought. A similar phantom coach with headless coachman, footmen, and horses haunts the grounds in adjoining region of Caister Castle in Norfolk. It is said that the headless ghost of Sir Jocelyn Percy drives 4 headless horses above the streets of Beverley, Yorkshire, on a certain night in the year at midnight, as punishment for an act of sacrilege. Also on certain nights of the year, the approach to Langley Hall, near Durham, is haunted by a phantom coach with headless horses, coachman, and footman. The headless ghost of a man who murdered his children at a house at Hampton Wood near Ellesmere appears at times in the grounds of the house. In Warwickshire, a man was driving a trap one night along a country road, when his horse suddenly shied, stood still, trembling all over, and then set off at a great speed. Looking round to see what had startled the horse, the driver saw the phantom of a headless man walking alongside the trap. No matter how fast the trap went, the ghost kept pace with it, without seeming to walk any faster. When the trap arrived at a turning in the road where an atrocious murder had been committed, the phantom suddenly vanished. The horse at once resumed its normal pace and took the driver home without anything further happening. A well-known story is that of Walter Caverly, who in a fit of frenzy murdered his children and attempted to kill his wife. For these crimes he was pressed to death. His phantom riding a headless horse has often been seen in the vicinity of his home. According to a tradition in the neighborhood, he was buried in the churchyard near his home, and boys used to go to the churchyard and call out, "Old Caverly, old Caverly, unless thee appears, we'll cut thee into callops and seize thee by the ears." On one occasion, while the boys were shouting these words, the church door opened and the ghost of Caverly, without his head, actually appeared. The terrified boys flew and never ventured near the churchyard again. A family in Limerick have as their ghost a phantom carriage drawn by headless horses. One Christmas Eve, when the family were gathered together in the sitting room, sounds of a carriage were heard. As they were not expecting anyone and the hour was late, they wondered who it could be. Nearer and nearer came the sounds of wheels. They could even hear the cracking of the driver's whip. Right up the drive, the carriage came at a fast rate, never pausing till it reached the front door. There was then a loud rapping. One of the girls went to the window, gave a cry, and fainted. The carriage drove away, and the girl, on recovering, told how she had seen at the window a coach with headless horses, a headless coachman, and a headless footman. Within a few days, the family heard that someone closely related to them had suddenly died. Finally, there is the following story of a well-known haunted family. Three sisters, Lily, Rose, and Ruth Webster, went on a visit one year to their uncle Robert Webster in Canada. He lived in a house standing in extensive grounds near a river. One evening when the family were in the sitting room, sounds of wheels were heard. A carriage and four was coming up the drive. It was too late for visitors and the girls wondered who it could be. The vehicle was coming at a great pace. They could hear the crunch of gravel in the drive. The vehicle came right up to the house and there was a loud knocking at the front door. The girls remembered that there was no knocker on the door. Their uncle warned them not to look out of the window and kneeling down prayed for deliverance from evil forces. In spite of his warning, Rose looked out of the window and saw, to her horror, a great hearse-like carriage with four headless horses and a headless coachman. She did not faint, but she was terribly shocked. The carriage remained at the door for a few moments, then drove away. The girls asked their uncle what was the meaning of the phantom carriage and why it had come, but he would not say. He begged them never to mention the phantom coach again. A few nights later, Lily woke with a start to see a tall hooded figure in black glide across the floor and bend over Rose's bed. Rose was fast asleep. The figure remained stationary for some seconds, then glided out of the room. Lily spent the rest of the night with her head under the clothes. A few days after this, the three girls were in the garden. They were walking along a path, chattering and laughing, when Lily sensed that someone was following them. She looked around and was terrified to see the hooded figure in black. It stretched out a long arm and touched Rose and Ruth on the back. It then turned and moved away with long strides and abruptly disappeared. The following week, the girls returned home, and within a month, Rose and Ruth were the victims of an epidemic and died.